You briefly mentioned before in your question when you were with the students about David, your thoughts on David Miliband, but what do you think of him as the new Labour leader?
Do you mean David?
Or
Ed
David? Oh,
Miliband.
sorry.
Well, I favoured Ed rather than David because David was the continuity candidate. He was saying Blair was great, it was great government, let's carry on. And I also think, although he's clever, I think he was quite arrogant. And when he was Foreign Secretary, he didn't change anything after all the errors of us following Bush into all the mess that was created. So, and Ed was saying some things the government did was good, but things need changing. And I thought Labour needed to examine what had been good and what had failed. And as you know, I mean, for the family, I think it's quite tough, the two brothers. And David's going to announce today whether he's carrying on, in senior positions in politics. And everyone thinks he's going to say that he's going to step down, which I think makes him look a bit petulant. I mean, if you go into an election, you've got to win or lose, But of course, it's felt particularly strongly by brothers. So I think for the country and the Labour Party, it's better that Ed won. And then Ed made his speech yesterday and he said some things are good, but we didn't regulate the banks enough, we didn't do enough about growing inequality, Iraq was wrong, the siege of Gaza is wrong, that attack on the flotilla was wrong. Well, I like all that, and those are the things that need correcting. So I'm pleased with Ed so far, but it's early days, and I'm glad it's not David.
Do you have a question?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. I personally known you for I'm stepping down from at the time of the Iraq War. I'm sorry, just a little bit nervous.
No, it's okay. I understand you.
Why didn't you do it immediately straight after? I know you stepped out of the cabinet, but you didn't actually leave the party.
Well, no, it, what you're asking is, I said I would leave the government if they didn't get UN approval. Then they didn't get UN approval, and I stayed for a couple of months and then left the cabinet.
Yeah.
That's what you're talking about.
Yeah.
The reason for that, I mean, it's all in the book and everything. When I said I'm leaving, Blair had me in, said, "What can I do to persuade you not to leave?" We had a big negotiation. I said, "You've done this wrong. You should do it through the UN. We should have acted on Palestine first. That's the soaring, scar of the Middle East that's making everyone so upset and angry. Plus, the situation is dreadful. And if it does come to conflict authorized by the UN, it should be UN-led reconstruction of Iraq, so it's not one country trying to dominate, it's really trying to help the people." And then in the end, he said, "I can get Bush to promise you progress on Palestine. I can get Bush to promise a reconstruction led by the UN, but I can't stop the conflict. But I want you to stay because then we can carry through these things." So I thought, okay, it's better to, if we can get Palestine and if we can get an international lead on the reconstruction of Iraq, it's better than what might otherwise happen. And indeed, I think still think it would have been, because there wasn't actually much killing in the conflict stage was over in a couple of weeks, and all the mess came later. And then Blair didn't keep his promises on those things. So I kind of compromised, because he promised a deal that he then broke, so I just left the government. And then I was on the back benches, but I was still in the Labour Party, and I thought the Labour Party would kind of have big arguments about what had happened and how we put it right. And then they didn't. The chief whip kept telling me off for saying something independently, and I thought, blow this, I've already said I'm not running in the next election. I'm not being vetoed in what I say, in my final. So I left the party too. Resigned the whip, which is what you call, the party discipline within the House of Commons.
Okay. Like you've mentioned before about Tony Blair, he likes to play with the media. He was really good at doing that, the dome situation. Did you actually have a genuine role in the cabinet, or were you one of the Tony Blair's yes men?
No, I was never one of his yes men. But as I said this morning, the cabinet didn't work as a decision-making structure. The role I did have was running my own department. We had this new Department for International Development, which in the prior to that there'd been a Overseas Development Administration, which looked after the UK aid budget, but was under the authority of the Foreign Secretary. So in the end, the decisions about how to use British aid took into account Britain's interests. Then when we had the separate department, it wasn't just the aid, then we could challenge on trade policy, what's going on at the IMF and the World Bank, in terms of how you make a just and fair, sustainable world. Mm-hmm. So I ran that department, we re-looked at everything we did, we challenged lots of policies across the government and got some change in the World Bank and some reform in the UN, and I ran that. And it was quite powerful, and it was a brilliant time, because before the War on Terror, those causes were advancing. You know, Nelson Mandela had been released, so some of the wars in Africa had ended. There was this sense of hope of a new world, you know, where we didn't have to spend money. So I ran that. But in terms of things outside my department that were decided by the government, I had very little influence. I challenged, I argued, and I used to get briefed against in the media because I dared to argue. Mm. That's Alistair Campbell's role. He really doesn't like me. I'm not keen on him either. Yeah.
Okay. The views of politicians in society are usually negative. What do you have to say about that?
I think it's deserved. Mm. I think it wasn't just the expenses thing. I think...
That was my next question.
Yeah, but it isn't only that. The mood of distrust to politicians was there before that. I mean, that obviously made it worse. But, and it's the stuff we've been talking about, you know, a very big majority in the Commons, but it's not a big majority in the country. Mm-hmm. And then driving through policy that the country doesn't like. Mm-hmm. And the Iraq War is the most spectacular example. There was the biggest demonstration that Britain's ever had in its history against the Iraq War. Mm-hmm. Nearly 2 million people turned out. There's never been such a big demonstration. And it was just completely ignored. And people think, well, who are these politicians? Who do they listen to? Aren't they supposed to represent us? You know, people were getting pretty fed up with all of that. And then along came the expenses scandal. And people just fiddling the system and lining their, you know. Mm-hmm. And it really shocked everyone. But I think it shocked them into more of what they were thinking anyway. It wasn't that they had total trust in politics, then it came along and it... and I share the critique. I think the political system is not working well, as I've been trying to explain this morning. I think the exaggerated majorities for one party, that means things are driven through the Commons without proper consideration because parties are whipped and disciplined and no one argues or dissents. The lack of cabinet government, which means things to please the media are just bounced through. I think it leads to bad government, and it leads politicians and then trying to get on and be important rather than solve problems and listen to what's bothering the country. Mm-hmm. And I think our system's gone wrong. But as I said as well, I think kicking out New Labour, which deserved to be kicked out, but not giving a clear majority to the Tories was smart. Yeah. Of the country. So it's saying, we're fed up with all of you, we've got to kick the government out because they need to learn a lesson. But we don't want a hard Tory government, we still remember what Thatcher did. Mm. So we'll just about let the Tories in and then they have to make a coalition to try and keep them. That was pretty good. But I think we need to change our voting system so that parties are represented in proportion to the support they've got in the country and they have a bit more humility and a bit more listening to what's bugging people and what's troubling people.
Okay. With that being said, do you feel like that Britain should have a constitution? Like, what are your views on it?
Written constitution.
Yeah.
I think probably now we should, because of course we've also got the House of Lords, which we haven't got all the hereditaries there anymore, but now we've got all these political appointees, and everyone promises an elected second chamber, but that hasn't been done. And now we've got Scotland and Wales having their own assembly and parliament. You've got some issues, like top-up fees, where the vote was carried. There was a big rebellion against it, which I was part of. That was after I'd left the government. And it was carried by a small majority, which was reliant on the Labour members for Scotland, and it didn't apply to Scotland. I mean, that's disgraceful. The things that have been devolved to Scotland and Wales, I think then just the English MPs should decide. So we've got a voting system problem, this problem. But I don't quite mind whether we have a big pause and a big written constitution or whether we have a series of reforms, whichever is the best way to get the changes.
Okay. My last question before I pass on to Alex. Ooh, have a little variety
well, let me
here.
Say, I'll add one thing on that.
Okay.
I think people said there was a disgrace in British foreign policy in 1956 when the Egyptians nationalised the Suez Canal and Britain, France and Israel conspired to pretend the canal was in danger so that they could invade and take it back. And then it was a plot. And actually, at that stage, the Americans stopped them. And there were lies told to the country again, just like there were lies over Iraq. So some people say the British Constitution is really flexible because it's not written down. But if this is the result of the flexibility, that you can make disastrous foreign policy decisions that are based on lies, then I think we should look at having rigid written constitutions so those things can't happen. So I think the case for written has become stronger, as well as the reforms that are needed. We need to entrench some powers that stop the executive lying and twisting. And
my last question is it a temptation as a politician to use expenses wrongfully?
Well, the system... What happened? And when I first was an MP, I think the maximum was about 10,000, and you weren't allowed to claim for mortgages and so on. So what happened was, they have this thing called the Senior Salaries Review Board, which sets the salaries of judges and the head of the armed forces and senior civil servants and so on. And they do one on MPs' pay. And Thatcher, it was embarrassing for the government to increase MPs' pay. So instead they dollop up the expenses and then say, and it's kind of like a fudge, we won't put your salaries up. Raise the ceiling, yes, you can claim your mortgage expenses and so on. And quite honestly, some of the things that came in, like the John Lewis list, I personally had never heard of it because it all came in gradually. So I think it was a rotten system, and I think if you have a very baggy system that encourages people to kind of claim to the max, any group of people would behave badly. So I think it's shameful and disgraceful. But the reasons it was put in place were also cowardly. I mean, the House of Commons shouldn't vote on its own salary. It should be set by some board that sets other salaries. Mm-hmm. And the expenses should just cover the real expenses, and you should have to bring an expenses chit for, you know, what you spend. Because some people do have to have two houses. You know, if you're outside London, you've got to have a place there and a place in London. But I think it's been tightened up now. But I do think... You know, journalists always have expenses, and you go to lunch with them and they say, oh no, have some more, have the most expensive thing, I can claim it. You know, you get that kind of culture around expenses, and it's not good. An expenses system should always be tighter. The other thing is, not everyone was fiddling, but the way the press reported it, it was though it was absolutely everyone. And it wasn't everyone. But there were some spectacular ones. Like
The moat
and the duck.
The duck,
you know, and that guy. he was a rich guy, that guy, Peter Vigors. He'd been a banker. And apparently he had a deal with the fees office that he'd send in all his chits and they'd tell him what he could buy, what he could claim. And they all said he couldn't claim for the duck house. Then he put the duck house up and the ducks didn't like it. So the ducks never used the duck house. And now it's just been in the press. He sold the duck house for charity. So the poor old duck house, which has become the symbol of the thing.
Yeah.
Even the ducks didn't like the duck house.
Okay, I have a little bit more personal questions for you. You started off as a civil servant for the Home Office. What made you decide to change from from being a civil servant to an MP?
The truth is, I never meant to be a civil servant for the whole of my life. I didn't plan to be a politician, but this was the 60s, you know, and in those days only about 6-7% of the population went to university. Women went in much smaller numbers. So when I found out people like us could go to university, it was incredible. And then in those days, any graduate always could get employment. And truthfully, most of the people who went to university were very well off, and a few of them, like us, squeaked through. And I got a full grant, you know. Yeah. And you could work in the holidays and get through. And it's good for you to work in the holidays because, you know, you get a feel of the kind of jobs people mm-hmm. have to do and the kind of wages they get. Mm-hmm. But so then I did political science because in those days you could study what you like because people were going to employ graduates, so you studied what you were interested in. And I was interested in political philosophy and political history and sociology and economics and so on. And then when I was looking for a job after I finished, there was a very privileged entry into the senior civil service. And I thought, well, I'll take those exams and go and have a look at the British establishment at work, which I did, and not meaning to spend my life there because I'm not really a neutral and an establishment person. And it was when I was there that I worked in the Office of Ministers and went to the House of Commons and thought, good heavens, these aren't very impressive. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking, these issues we're dealing with in the Home Office, prison policy, immigration policy, Northern Ireland was in the Home Office then, really matter, but I'm not a neutral. And then when I saw the politicians, I thought, I could do that, and then I could come back and, you know, put it right. So that's the story. I mean, I went into the civil service in order to have a look at how, at the top level, the British system worked. And it's then I saw politicians in the flesh. And before that, I would have thought people like me couldn't be a politician. But when I saw them in the flesh, I thought, yeah, I could do that. So that's the story.
Okay. You're also a member of many organisations and trusts for involving Eastern and Middle Eastern countries in Africa. Where did your passion for change come from?
Well, my father was Irish. He was a teacher in Birmingham in a city school. And he came from Northern Ireland, which was partitioned by the British when they were leaving Ireland. Yeah, you know, after poor old Ireland was the first colony and kept revolting and kept being smashed. Yeah. And they partitioned just 3 miles south of his village, so his bit still stayed in Britain. And in those days, people of Irish Catholic nationalist stock were quite discriminated against. So he was quite cross about that. And so we grew up in a house where the British Empire, what it did in Ireland, what it did in Africa, what it did in India was not, you know, we knew oppressing another people is not right, etc. Those kind of values. So some of it just comes out of my family. My mother's from potato famine, Irish. There was dreadful famine in Ireland in the 1840s and millions died. And my great-great-grandfather came to Birmingham to escape the famine, and my mother's comes from that family. So you can see, it's in my roots. I was also thoroughly brought up as a Catholic, and that commitment to sort of truthfulness and everyone being of equal importance that I got from my Catholic childhood sticks with me. I'm no longer a practicing Catholic because their teachings on that people shouldn't use contraception and so on are just ridiculous, and I can't be doing it. But some of the best of it stays in me. So I think it came out of... And I suppose my temperament is, I mean, I like people. And I don't like snobbery and greed. And, I mean, I grew up in Handsworth. Mm. So I'm an inner city kid, really. And, you know, when you go to Gaza, they're great people, very dignified. And they're just, it's just miserable. It's sinful what's happening to them. It's wrong. I mean, it's breach of international law, but it's just morally wrong. Mm. And when you go to villages in Africa, people are so dignified. But you see children walking to school with no shoes on and with a lovely dress that their mum's made for them and going a long way because they're so determined to get some education. And it moves your heart. And you think, we could make the world safer as well as more just. Because in these times, it's so dangerous now. And the only way to really make the world safe is to make it more fair right across the piece. And then humanity can cooperate. You know, we can solve the Middle East, give the Palestinians their state, stop propping up horrible dictatorships in the Middle East because they'll be pro-Western even though their people are furious. Mm. And give Africa the chance for children to be educated, people to have a decent chance to improve their own life. Africa has moved forward, actually, in the last 10 years. Mm. So... Sorry, what the answer to your question is, I don't know, it's me. It's my family, it's my temperaments, it's my life experience. It's right as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I have two more questions for you. Do you have any regrets about joining the Labour Party in the beginning or in the end leaving?
I regret, if I knew now what I, if I knew then what I know now, I would have resigned from the government, you know, before the war and teamed up with Robin Cook, and we might well have got the Labour Party to sort of face up to what had happened. Mm. I've got lots of regrets in my personal life, as every human being has. Not sort of, you know, not enough to be suicidal, but lots of things you think, oh gosh, I could have done that better, and I shouldn't have shouted at that person, and I could have been, you know, blah. But I don't regret going into politics. I loved being a constituency MP. I loved my constituents. My time at the Department for International Development was fabulous, and we did some good, and it convinced me that we could make the world more just and decent if we all just got to it and meant it and used our abilities and intelligence, and it's the only way to make the world safe. I mean, I regret what happened to the Labour Party, and I think about, you know, whether I could have helped to avoid that. But so lots of regrets, and obviously around the Iraq thing. But I know why I did it, and I did. I stayed for good reasons. Mm-hmm. So I'm not ashamed of that. But with hindsight, I don't think we could have stopped the war. I mean, the vote in the House of Commons was overwhelming because the Tories were voting with the government. It was just a question of the size of the revolt. So that's the answer. Some regrets, but not... not sort of such big, what's that, regrets I have a few, that song. I always think, well, regrets I have lots and lots, but not mega.
Okay. And finally, my last question is, what advice would you give a young person that wants to go into politics?
Well, I would say go and study, get good qualifications, because your generation, it's tough out there. Mm-hmm. And the better the qualifications you can get, then you can get into a decent job. And then I'd say, both as a student, in the work you choose, develop your skills, develop your confidence about speaking. And it doesn't have to be in a political forum, you know, it can be in an NGO, in a church, in a organising. Do keep your feet in some way in the community. You might do it through voluntary work. Stay in touch with people so you know what really matters. Mm. And then also, women have to think about when they're going to fit in having their children. So you have to, I mean, a lot of the women who were elected in 97 then immediately had babies soon after the election. But you need to develop your skills, get a good profession, so you get a good reputation and you get your confidence up. And then there are different routes in. You can do it through going into local government. You can do it through being in some kind of campaigning organisation, you know, like, say, Sammy Chakravarti, someone who gets a reputation. And go for it, is the other thing I would say. We need good people who know how the world is to get into politics, not just smoothies who want to be important for its own sake, and there's too many of them.
I think that's it. Thank you very much for your time.
It's a pleasure meeting you.